Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to the latest member of a comedic dynasty, Kip Friedman. What dynasty is that, you ask? The Friedmans, of course. Novelist and playwright Bruce J. Friedman, artist and caricaturist Drew Friedman, and musician and writer Josh Allen Friedman. As for Kip, he just published his first book, a memoir, Barracuda in the Attic. Stick around, but please feed your neighborhood land sharks. You wouldn't want to see them when they're hungry. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview, brought to you by Amazon.com, Audible.com, and 1-800-DIAL-DJs. Please stop by the website, MrMedia.com, click on our advertisers, support the show. And remember, there's more than 1,000 interviews available at MrMedia.com. We've been doing this since February 2007. Hope you'll find something you like. And thanks for listening. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of people named Friedman, two N's, who don't understand the fuss about the family with one less letter than them, in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. One of the happier accidents in my career came when I was adopted by the Friedmans. Oh, I wasn't an orphan. Not that there's anything wrong with that. But the Friedman family, originally of New York, has been very kind to me. First was caricaturist Drew Friedman, currently best known for his series of art books featuring old Jewish comedians. Becoming friends with him was an outgrowth of a slight in my biography of comic book master Will Eisner. And Drew has been on the show twice since then, the second time spending time with my daughter and me at the International Society of Caricature Artists 2 years ago in St. Pete Beach. When Drew's father, popular novelist, playwright, and screenwriter Bruce J. Friedman, published his memoir, Lucky Bruce, Drew convinced his dad to come on the show and do a video interview. He was delightful, and it's a conversation that anyone interested in Bruce's body of work, or writing in general, should really watch. Now today, I'm joined by the youngest of the three Friedman boys, Kip, who's just released his own memoir of life in the Friedman family, Barracuda in the Attic. Now, Barracuda is actually the Friedman book that is closest to my own experience. We're roughly the same age, and we're influenced, and scared in many cases, by many of the same pop culture moments of the last half century, from comic books and horror movies, to both of us in the mid-1960s standing at Yankee Stadium and seeing Mickey Mantle hit one of the final home run blasts of his career. As for Josh Allen Friedman, the oldest of Bruce's three sons, and the only one yet to make an appearance here, next move is up to you. Doors wide open, Josh. Kip Friedman, welcome to Mr. Media.
Welcome, Bob.
Glad to have you here. So somehow you resisted the urge to title the book Growing Up Friedman, huh?
I had a lot of titles, and Barracuda in the Attic seemed to be the most popular among my publishers, so I trusted them.
I like that. Do you want to? Is it wrong to ask you to give away why Barracuda in the Attic?
Well, a lot of people ask me, about that. Was there really a barracuda in the attic? Or was it symbolic of something deeper, more meaningful, perhaps a dark family mystery? And actually, the true story is my dad caught a barracuda while he was in the Caribbean island of Bimini, Isle of Bimini, in the late 60s while on assignment for the Saturday Evening Post. He was trying to catch Adam Clayton Powell Jr., the congressman from New York, and he was kind of given a short end of the rod. I'm using a lot of fish analogies, I apologize. It just comes to mind. But he did catch a barracuda in his off time, and we remember the barracuda arriving home in Great Neck, Long Island, where we lived in the mid-60s. I was about seven, and I remember my dad taking it out of the box, and he put it in his attic studio office where he did most of his work. And I just spent a lot of time marveling at this wonderful creature with the fangs and the colored gills, and I would touch its button-like dark eyes. The fangs reminded me of Long Chaney Sr. in the horror, silent horror movie London After Midnight, which I saw pictures of in Famous Monsters of Filmland magazine. So my brothers and I just would marvel at that barracuda. And that brought me back to my dad's office study, and I was able to then piece it back together again, what his working conditions were like, what our memories were. Often you take an incident or an object or a smell even, and it's a nice vehicle to get you back into that period. And so I used that and went with it.
I used it well. And it's not, best I can tell after reading the book, it does not, it's not emblematic of some horror in the Friedman family.
No, but if I make a comparison to, it wasn't the 400-pound blue marlin that Santiago had caught in Hemingway's Old Man in the Sea, but it was still a respectable-sized barracuda.
True.
And one could make the, the analogy to, the marlin being Hemingway, the great big fish, and my dad being more of the sleek barracuda floating through the Gulf Stream. Some have said that. That thought occurred to me, but after I wrote the story.
Got it.
So I'll use that as a metaphor. I was being very clever.
All right. Now, at the end of Barracuda, jumping from the title to the end of the book, which may seem a little odd to people, but at the end of Barracuda, you actually let your oldest brother get the last word in. Josh wrote, and I'm going to read it verbatim here. If for some reason someone were to read my own Black Cracker, that's the title of his memoir, my father's Lucky Bruce, that's Bruce's memoir, and Kip's Barracuda in the Attic, they would assume each took place in a separate universe. They did. It kind of made me wonder what would happen if my brother, my sister, and I ever wrote competing memoirs. Not that anyone would care much about our lives, but it's interesting how the perspective now, I have not read Black Cracker, I have to say that. I have read Lucky Bruce, and I did read Barracuda in the Attic. It's very different. There's a lot of I'm not saying that the stories wouldn't match up if we lined up and say, okay, this is Kip talking about this, and this is Bruce talking about this, or Josh talking about this. But you really get a broader sense of family and history in this manner.
Well, my dad's memoir, Lucky Bruce, he described it as a literary memoir. So it's his story as a writer, his remembrances growing up, the things that influenced him in, as a child in the Bronx, and then going to college in Missouri, and then when he worked in magazines in the late 50s and early 60s, and then his opening the door at New Yorker, getting articles published, and so on, movies and plays and the rest. Josh, my oldest brother, wrote what he called an autobiographical novel. And it's about his childhood growing up when we lived in Glen Cove in the late 50s and early 60s. I was really about five when we left Glen Cove. So that's his experience. I really don't show up much in his book. I mentioned three times, and with one reference to me being tough and athletic like him. That's it. And then I disappear. In fact, in my dad's book, Lucky Bruce, I'm mentioned only once by name, and that's in reference to a trip to the south of France where we arrived late, starving, and we stopped at the only restaurant that was still open, a Vietnamese restaurant. Supposedly, I said, after eating a bite of the slice of pizza, "This isn't pizza. There's no cheese on it." And up until then, they'd never heard a peep out of me. So that's his, me rising to the occasion. But then you don't hear anything more from me in his memoir. My memoir, I wanted to be participatory. I wanted to talk about my childhood and my brothers, my grandparents, my memories of incidents that, that I recall with my father, with my mother, their relationship. And the things that inspired me or influenced me, like our obsession with comic books or our youthful quest to find the scariest horror movies on 42nd Street and Broadway, all stemming from an incident where we saw Night of the Living Dead when I was about seven. It's not the appropriate film to take a seven-year-old to, mind you.
No.
but it was the second feature in a Saturday matinee, and no one knew about it. There were about five people in the audience, and it scared the crap out of us. But we stayed, and I did not have nightmares, although my brother Drew did his best to give me nightmares. For months on afterward, at that night, he would say, "They're coming to get you, Barbara. There's one now." And I would look, you know. So these things stuck with us. We also were taken to this old warehouse of a store we called the Back Issue Store, where old comic books and magazines, and nudie magazines too, occasionally. We were just there, and people would go to get back issues. Well, there weren't kids there except us. And so those memories of the smells, of the creaky floors, of us barreling in like bulls into a china shop to get in, you know, and collect what we could before my dad looked at his watch and said, "All right, boys," you know, and we were on a budget. It's part of our childhood. So I wanted to piece it all together and honor my family, honor my relationship, tried to be objective and honest, and but it's a memoir, so it's my viewpoint. I think I did a pretty good job.
I think you did. And it's funny, the back issue shop reminded me, growing up in New York, New Jersey area myself, a number of places like that I remember going to, and it had places that had like half the covers torn off because they were returned. And anyway, I could smell that place. I could feel that place as you described it. It was neat. I'm curious, until Barracuda, I mean, you've managed to keep your life kind of out of the private eye, the public eye. What changed? What made you want to tell the story as opposed to just maybe telling it and just keeping it within the family? Why go public?
Well, when I was a teenager, after my parents divorced, I moved in with my father for about a year and a half before going off to college. And we lived like two bachelors on East 63rd Street and First Avenue in Manhattan. We had a lot of adventures. I went with him on business trips, met a lot of writers. He took me with him everywhere. We just had a lot of fun. I got to see his daily workings as a writer. And that was a very meaningful period in my life before leaving for college. It was sort of like a coming of age time for me. And he was the midsection of his career. He was kind of getting his bearings straight. This was his Lonely Guy articles period of his life, where he was a bachelor. There were women, but he hadn't picked a leading lady yet, let's put it that way. So I always remembered that as a very important time in my life where things were, I wasn't really sure where I fit in, and it stabilized me until I went off to college. I mean, I wasn't in trouble, but it was just a lot of fun. So years later, my dad, I was recalling with him how special that period was, you know, meaningful. And he said, "Yeah, it was a lot of fun, and it would make a great story." So my first response was, "I can't wait to read what you write, Dad." You know, he's a famous writer.
Conditioned.
But he said, "No, you should write it." And I said, "Okay, I will." And then 10 years later, the thought occurred to me while I was sitting in front of my computer, there'll never be as much time as I write this moment to write that story. So I did. I wrote it. It was called Life with Father, 1977-78. And it was published on a literary website in Manhattan. Received a lot of favorable coverage from friends and family, comments. And then I got a message from an editor, HarperCollins, saying, "If you have more stories, this would make a great book." So I was thrilled. Visions of a huge cash advance and living in the English countryside where I could write seclusion danced in my head. Unfortunately, when I spoke to the editor, she said, "No, you're like a college baseball prospect who hit a home run and caught the eye of the scouts. Come back to us when you've written more of your stories, and then we'll take a look, nothing more." Well, I was crestfallen, and I only had one story, so it forced me to start looking deeper and look back further into my childhood for inspiration, and that's kind of what got the ball rolling.
Do you think – you know, this is interesting. I've got a teenage daughter, 17, getting ready to go off to college, and turns out that all these years of resisting, she actually can write a good tale and has done very well with that, although she still resists. Do you think there's a gene that has been passed from your dad to the three boys, whether it's just a general creative gene? Is it because you grew up in a creative environment? What do you think it is?
I think the latter. I think just being exposed to lots of books and manuscripts around the house, listening to my dad's stories from day one. He's a great storyteller, and he tends to alter, embellish, make things bigger than perhaps they are, but make them feel special. And that's something that rubbed off on all of us in some way or another. And Drew, it's in his artwork. He sees things that other people don't see. He captures lost ephemera. I mean, B-movies stars that, you know, Tor Johnson. Who thinks about Tor Johnson? Shemp Howard. I mean, Shemp is now a you know, lives along in many people's lives because of Drew. And he should, by the way. Shemp should. We were encouraged to tell stories along with our father. It's no surprise that we all gravitated to the arts. I'm a photographer as well as a writer, and I'm a publicist. So, you know, and I was a newspaper reporter in an earlier career. Josh was a writer for magazines, and he's been a musician. He's performed, and he's had a number of books published, and Drew, of course, has gone off in the art world. So we're all artists, but even my mother is an acting teacher and coach and had a career helping other actors. So it wasn't discouraged. But I'll give you another reason why I wrote this book. It's somewhat self-serving. I have a bookshelf behind me filled with Friedman books. Drew's, Josh's, my dad's, even my mother's on acting. There's no Kip Friedman there. So in the back of my head, I always knew I wanted to have a book with my name so I could be accepted among my family. So now I got like six books squeezed in there in between my family's books. So I feel at home now.
Interesting. And it's funny. I completely expect my daughter to surpass my output. I've got 16 on a shelf right now. I have a feeling she will pass that. I hope I live long enough to see it, you know. Was it daunting, though, to finally commit and to write that first book, being, you know, in the family? I mean, I'm sure you were encouraged, but I also know from reading your book, especially, that the three boys in particular were very competitive with each other at many points in life. You know, how did that go when you got the word around to the boys that, hey, I'm writing a book about us?
Well, it's funny. When I first told Drew I was writing my first story, Life with Father, I used an expression, I'm working on a piece. And Drew perked up because that's the expression my dad used to say in the 60s and 70s when we were kids. I'm working on this piece for Playboy, for Esquire, for Antioch Review. And so when he heard that, he said, oh, you mean like Dad, like an article to be published in Esquire? I said, yeah. And he didn't expect that, but then he took it very seriously because that's very meaningful to us. I have only had positive experiences from my brothers, my father, my mother. Anybody associated with these stories has been very supportive. I've used the word participatory. Everyone has read the stories prior to publication. And I'd like to report that no one has said, you can't write that. And there are no lawsuits that I know of pending. Although, my brother Josh, he'll probably get mad at me, but I'll say it anyway. He sent me a note recently saying, did you have to write so much about the family? And my dad responded when I told him, he said, it's a memoir. What do you want? Blank pages? You know, it's a family memoir. So, but everyone's been very encouraging, supportive. It's almost like, you know, you're now one of us. You're accepted. It's not like they didn't accept me, but I think in our family, you're taking a little bit more, maybe seriously, you know, a little more gravitas if you've written it down.
And you're still even at how old are you, Kip?
I'm 53.
Okay. Yeah, I thought so. I'm the same age. And I'm the oldest of three. You're the youngest of three. I'm guessing that you're still kind of fighting that uphill battle all the way. And you know, I made a note to myself. I described Josh in the book that I felt like he came off as this rough and tumble kid throughout. Drew was sort of the prankster. And your dad is the creative genius who was there for you guys, but maybe not as much as you would have liked. And I'm thinking, here you are, you've got this book, you're in the club. You've been a member of the family for 53 years, but now, damn it, you're in the club.
Well, there are actually other people in our lives that were waiting for this to happen that have even commented, you know, wait to hear from the youngest one. I'm sure he's got something. So apparently there were people saying, what took so long, you know?
late bloomer. What are you going to do?
Yeah, exactly.
I wanted to ask you, you mentioned your mom. I didn't realize that your mom had written a book. And that's part of what I was kind of getting to. Your mom doesn't get a whole lot of attention, a whole lot of detail in your book, I thought. And in your in your dad's case, in Lucky Bruce, it's understandable because they divorced, they split. It wasn't always the best of post-marital situation. But I came away feeling like I want to know more about mom, you know. And I got to say, there's a stunning photograph of her as a young woman, absolutely beautiful woman. And I just felt like I want to know more about her. Now, my question is, did you not go into much detail about her out of deference to her? Is that her preference, or did you just feel, I don't know, I was kind of curious?
Well, actually, there are two mother figures in my life that reoccur throughout the book, probably get equal billing, I would say. One is my mom, who's in a number, it's probably written about in every single story, by the way. And then there's Mrs. Sullivan, who was our childhood babysitter and housekeeper, and raised me since I was an infant until about age 15 when she moved to Long Island, and the whole family kind of went in different directions, and I moved with my dad. So I had a biological mother, Ginger Friedman, and Mrs. Sullivan, who did the diapers and greeted me when I came home from school and made sure we were fed every night and maybe stood as an intermediary between me and my older brother, Josh. We loved her, but she was a regular figure, stabilizing figure in our lives. My mother was more about fun, about having a great experience, about having a good time. The theme about my parents' on again, off again marriage occurs throughout the book. It's a subplot, I guess. So my mother was there, but she was also had her own life. And my mother has commented a few times, everybody else is mentioned in the publicity about your book. What about me? Do they think there's no mother? And I said, Mom, you're written about in every single story. I dedicate the book to you. So I tell her now, well, the next book will be all about you.
There you go. I came away from the book wanting to know more about Ginger. I just felt like, obviously, I mean, your dad's almost bigger than life outside of the family, probably a little bigger than life within the family. I get that, Drew and Josh, and there's three boys. There's the competition among the boys. But I actually came away wondering more and more about this woman who is, you know, who all this kind of swirled around. But mentioning her is different than – I just felt like I didn't have a complete picture of her. So I'd love to read more about your mom. Let's leave it at that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
fair enough.
Please tell her I said hello. It was also interesting. I mentioned this in the introduction. I felt – and I guess the ages are similar. We grew up in adjacent areas. I grew up in Central Jersey. You grew up in New York. The influences are very similar in a metropolitan area like that for boys of a certain age. But when the stunner for me was when you read about being at Yankee Stadium to see, you know, your dad wanting you to see Mickey Mantle before the end of his career. I went back to my grandfather, who was basically my father figure. My dad wasn't that involved. He was around, but not that involved. My grandfather took me to Yankee Stadium to see the Mick in that last season. And he hit a home run that day. But what I remember, I have to acknowledge, is my grandfather always got tickets in the nosebleed section, which terrified me. You know, the seats, you had this little narrow walkway between the seats. That's everything kind of tilted like this. So you're looking down. It may, just, you know, vertigo terrified me. But was there nonetheless. And so when I read your account of, you know, going there for that, I just felt like, okay, I know this guy. I know what, you know.
Well, I was more impressed, frankly, that Joe Pepitone hit two home runs that day. Joe Pepitone with his long hair, and he was like the hippie of the team. And the Mick was the aging lion who looked, like he was falling apart, but he still walloped one out of the park that night.
I remember being a big Joe Pepitone fan. It was like, wow, Joe Pepitone. And, now it's like, Joe who?
But there's a funny story about him and Mick. They were roommates on the road the final year. And once Joe Pepitone turned Mick on to, and allegedly turned him on to, a hit of marijuana. And the Mick then went up to bat. And normally when he struck out, he would take these mighty wops and throw his bat across the field in disgust and throw his hat and helmet down. Well, after hanging out with Joe, he just gently placed the bat down and kind of walked away, and then later said, Joe, don't you ever give me that stuff again. Something like that.
He should have done what Doc Ellis did.
Well, then he probably would have run backwards from third base to first base.
That's a story for another time. Boy, that Doc Ellis story, man. So what, in terms of coming back to the writing of the book, what were kind of the highs and lows for you of writing memoir for the first time? Was it hard?
Well, the hardest part was starting, really. Once you get going, I mentioned earlier about finding memories, objects, expressions, things that you remember people telling to you, or smells, and using those as literary devices to pull you back. I settled on a theme. Each story has its own specific angle. And the players are the same in different periods in my childhood, but I want each story to stand on its own. If you walk away, you know that the Barracuda in the Attic story is about my memories in my dad's office. But Our War with the Shanbergs is a story about a unique period where we had kind of a Jewish suburban 1960s Hatfields versus the McCoy kind of dispute with our neighbors, the Shanbergs, next door. So I wanted each story to stand on its own. And once I knew what I wanted to write story by story, they kind of fell into place one at a time. I always knew I wanted to write, for instance, about my trips out to Hollywood with my dad and my brothers, and that would be a theme in itself. So, they're not in sequential order. There's no real linear order to the stories. They're all separate, and I go back and forth in time, but I stay true to the same theme, and that was done on purpose. So it's not a straight narrative.
You and I were talking before we started officially about it's kind of a dream sequence coming from after your folks split, and your dad was getting on with his life with women, mom was getting on with her life with other men. You had a bit of a dream. Do you want to maybe share a little of that?
Yeah, and I can set it up a little bit. After my parents divorced in 1976-ish, my mother had a new boyfriend named Bob. Bob looked like a cross between Al Pacino in Serpico and the rock guitarist Carlos Santana. He also had this dopey, off-kilter laugh that reminded me of Tommy Chong. So he's 14 years younger than my mother. He had long black hair and a goatee. I had a dream about Bob and how that effect, and I'll find it just take a second, I apologize. This is the technical part of Skype interviewing where you look up stuff.
That's okay. We can have a little musical interlude here.
We can have a little musical interlude. I apologize. Oh, okay.
These are real moments. This is what we look for.
Yeah, this is riveting. Skype. Keep talking, Bob, I look for it.
And I should point out that the cover of Barracuda in the Attic is done by, big surprise, a Friedman. This is Drew. Drew the cover of the book, which people have seen by now, and it has this poor, sad-looking photo. Image of Josh. A lot of the photos of you look kind of forlorn, I have to say.
Yeah, we Well, a lot of it is we're confounded. It's like, what the hell just happened? What's going on? Me, especially with my big eyes, which Drew captured beautifully on the cover. I mean, he even told me he thought he really captured this tremulous kind of where do I fit kind of look, being the youngest brother. And let's face it, we're all kind of a bunch of narcissists in a way, and clamoring for attention. And I was like observing it all, and like a reporter. And that's why it's actually helpful in my writing. Now, speaking of my writing, I did find the dream sequence. Thank you for your patience, audience. And I'll begin reading. About this time, I had a prophetic dream that summed up the rudderless feelings I must have been keeping bottled up inside. I was in the backseat of a World War I era fighter plane when my mother's boyfriend Bob, behind the controls, his long hair spilling out of his aviator's goggles and cap. The plane zigzagged wildly through snow-capped mountains while Bob giggled uncontrollably, like Tommy Chong. And I shouted that I wanted to get off because I knew at any moment the plane would crash. As in most dreams, I awoke not knowing the outcome. Sadly, within a year, Bob would die of a massive heart attack at age 33. So that's the dream I had, literally, before I moved in with my father. And my dad remembers that dream. And actually, it's amazing. He told me when I was writing the story in the, you know, about 6 years ago, he said, "Why don't you write about that dream?" I was amazed that he remembered that. He does pay attention. He does look at details. And I've learned from him.
Well, of course, something bad in the dream happened to your mother's boyfriend. So I'm not surprised he remembered it.
Yeah, maybe it was. I hadn't thought of that, but thanks.
You're welcome.
I'd like to think he was, he wasn't wishing for anyone's demise.
No, but
It's a strong dream. It was a powerful. It was kind of prophetic. I mean, I just knew that it was a bumpy ride, and he wasn't the father figure that perhaps I could imagine, and I really needed to. Get off the airplane.
Get off
literally.
The merry-go-round with this one. All right. Yeah. Do you want to, before we kind of wrap up, do you want to tell folks what it is you do for a day job?
Oh, I do a lot of things. I am a part-time marketing and public relations person at the Jewish Community Center of Milwaukee. I am a photographer in the Milwaukee area. I've shot about 300 bar and bat mitzvahs. I've been to more bat mitzvahs and bar mitzvahs than anyone I know, and which is ironic since I didn't have one of my own. So I think it's someone's retribution or divine intervention saying, this is what you get for not having a bar mitzvah. So I'm not closing the door on that. I may in the future. I'm also a publicist. I do that a little bit for people. I put people in front of Skype and get stories in newspapers and magazines. And now I'm, publicizing myself, shamelessly. Sometimes.
Not here anyway. And
no,
are
not
you,
with
are you encouraged
business.
Enough that you would want to do this again?
I absolutely. This is a lot of fun. I have a lot of stories. I lived in Florida where you are. I've been there. I've seen alligators. I've covered alligators, and good old boys, and been to a Klan rally.
Skeeters as big as alligators.
Skeeters as big as alligators.
Well, folks, listen, you can find Kip Friedman's new book, his first, probably not his last. It's called Barracuda in the Attic. It's in great bookstores everywhere, or you can order it right now at a great price at MrMedia.com. If you're watching this on the site, just below the video, which would put it probably right over there, but it might be over here, you can just click on the cover of the book. It'll take you to Amazon.com. You'll get a great price, and you can have it instantly if you order the ebook, or within a day or two if you want the physical stuff. Kip, do you have a website? Are you on Twitter, Facebook, any of that kind of stuff?
Facebook, but I'm a bit of a Luddite. Facebook, Kip Friedman. Twitter, I'm not so sure about.
You are definitely a Friedman.
A funny story. a funny story. When Mario Puzo was a friend of my dad's, one of the last things he said before he passed away was, "I'm so glad I don't have to deal with the F in the internet."
I thought you were going to tell me he said, "Buy Facebook stock when it comes up."
He didn't say F.
No,
F
somehow
either,
I didn't think that he did. That would seem out of character for that man. Well, Kip, I enjoyed the book. I really related to it personally. I think anyone our age will, and certainly, you know, anyone familiar with any of the Friedmans will enjoy this. And thank you so much for joining us on Mr. Media today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
You can see and hear almost 1,000 Mr. Media interviews by visiting our main site, MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com. Or check out the more than 200 video interviews on the Mr. Media Radio site on YouTube. And I'd sure appreciate it if you'd show some love for Mr. Media's advertisers, including Stitcher. Apple named Stitcher a top 5 news app of 2011. It's a free mobile app for your smartphone or tablet that lets you listen to your favorite shows and discover the best of news, entertainment, and sports on demand. You can listen whenever you want to more than 5,000 shows, get customized recommendations, and discover what your friends are listening to. My own list of Stitcher favorites is pretty eclectic. I start my day with an hour of MSNBC's Morning Joe with Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski. Then it's the latest 2-minute update from the Onion News Network. After that, I'll listen to WTF with Mark Maron, Here's the Thing with Alec Baldwin, HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher, and excerpts from E's Chelsea Lately and The Soup with Joel McHale. Also in regular rotation on my Stitcher playlist, The BS Report with ESPN's Bill Simmons, The TechCrunch Headlines, and The Don Geronimo Show. The latest episodes of each show, whether originating from broadcasts, cable TV, radio syndication, or podcasts, are continuously updated. Stitcher is a free app for your iPhone, iPad, Kindle, Fire, BlackBerry, Droid, and more. And show your support of Mr. Media by getting, did I mention it's free? The app at stitcher.com/Mr. Media. That's stitcher.com/MR Media. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. We're also supported by Audible. Check out Audible's 30-day trial membership and download the audiobook version of the book everyone's been talking about, 50 Shades of Grey by E.L. James. Sign up for your free trial today at audible.com/radio. Again, audibletrial.com/radio. And finally, if you need a disc jockey for a wedding, bar mitzvah, corporate event, or just a big old party, please consider calling 1-800-DIAL-DJS, the party authority, for all your party entertainment needs. You can call 1-800-DIAL-DJS or go to their website, 1-800-DIAL-DJS.com, and tell them Mr. Media sent you. And thanks for listening.